So, Berto, have you seen the TV show on Netflix called Mindhunter? Mindhunter?
Have I ever?
Did you like it?
I did. I did enjoy it.
How many out of 10 stars would you give it? How many out of 10 Bertos?
You know, 7.58.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I would give it a 7.
Yeah.
There were, in the beginning, I liked it a lot more than as it sort of went on.
Oh, that's funny. I was sort of the opposite.
Really? I thought that the beginning was very intriguing, and I was really intensely watching because I didn't know what was happening. Because the first scene where there's that one guy who takes his clothes off, I thought it was going to be like X-Files or something.
Right.
Because I had no idea what it was going to be about.
I had the same lack of knowledge and same first expectation.
Yeah, I was like, wait, so it's like, oh, is this going to be like Supernatural?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, like at what moment does he actually disappear?
Yeah, exactly. Just 10 episodes, which I enjoy. I like these bingeable seasons.
Right.
That aren't like 30 episodes a season. You know, it's just 10 episodes, which is pretty easy to watch over a short amount of time.
And in the end, in spite of that first impression, it didn't try to do too much.
Right.
You know, it kept to a fairly sort of narrow path in a good way.
Yeah. Interesting subject matter, true story, mostly true. You know, if you haven't seen it, I'm guessing you'll like it if you don't have anything else to binge, you know, and I'm guessing you'll enjoy it, particularly if you like police procedurals, because it's basically a fancy Law and Order show.
Yeah.
But historical in that it's in the 70s and it's about the FBI and it's about the beginning understanding of serial killers.
Well, and a lot of stuff I didn't know or even think about. Like, you know, when you've been alive for even a little bit of time, you tend to assume that things have always worked out the same way.
Yeah, I want to get into that. Yeah. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I import T-shirts from Peru.
This, again, Netflix 2017, 10 episodes, 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. I feel like whenever there's a good TV show, it ends up having like a really high Rotten Tomatoes rating.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
It's like, I think it's because TV reviewers have very low expectation, or you know what I mean? Like when there's a good show, they're all like, whoa, that was great. You know?
But I also think people do this too. Like I see this on my Facebook feed. Where, like, there'll be a storm of enthusiasm around the new thing. And I'm not saying, again, I liked it. It's just, I think the hype was a little overboard for a bit.
Yeah, right. I understand if people like this show, for sure. I gave it a 7 out of 10. But I can't understand how anyone would be, like, mind blown.
Not Mindhunter, mind blowers.
You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, and it's got some problems with it, too, which I want to get into. Based on the book Mindhunter, written by FBI agent John Douglas, Holden Ford is based on the John Douglas character. So they took a nonfiction book and slightly fictionalized it. I don't know why.
Changed some names.
Yeah, I don't know. They changed some things, but not other things. And I'm guessing it's because they wanted some liberty with regards to the characters behind, you know, what they did with their personal life, so that the author didn't feel like he had to have his life on display or something.
Like many of the killers were real.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all the main ones are. Yeah.
I think some of the side plots are not.
Right.
Because they wanted to have the surprise. Like, we didn't know who did it.
Right. Produced by David Fincher and Charlize Theron, among
I didn't know she was involved.
Yeah, among other people.
Oh.
Four episodes are directed by Fincher, the first two and the last two. Yeah. Very similar feel and subject matter to Zodiac. Have you seen
that? Right.
By David Fincher.
Yeah.
Which I also gave 7 out of 10. Gyllenhaal, Mark Ruffalo, Anthony Edwards, Robert Downey Jr.
I guess I'd say I liked Zodiac better than I liked this show, so I would have given that one a solid 8.
Yeah, for sure. I liked Zodiac better in that it's faster paced, also a true story.
And maybe not fair, because it's one concise movie.
Right.
This has to be a whole 10 episode.
Right. Right. So for, you know, maybe it's like for a TV show, 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
And for a movie, 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
You know. So let's talk about what we liked. What are the good things that we sure. liked about it? The scenes with the serial killers were really interesting. I thought.
Yeah. That one dude stole the show too.
Ed Kemper. Yeah.
I forget the actor's name, but
yeah.
He was great. I watched the videos of the real Ed Kemper. And actually, they did a good job of not just copying. Like, it's not, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, he's identical. Actually, he's not. Like, they really added, like, a little extra autistic flair to it or something. Or Asperger's. Like they made him a little less sociable. And, whereas the real Ed Kemper sounded actually more normal.
Right.
At least from the videos I watched. But anyways, the guy was phenomenal. He was so, and they picked like this huge dude and the guy was tall and everything. So you felt this ominous sense from the beginning. You're like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Don't say the wrong thing. Please don't say the wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I also thought one of the most interesting parts of this whole show for me was how the FBI and how police work in general in the 70s, which I never knew, had troubles integrating psychology into their detective work.
Yeah. So that was another thing I liked was that it was actually pretty educational because I, for some reason, assumed that the FBI was at the cutting edge of psychology.
Well, right? And they were, but
eventually, I guess.
There had to be a point where they became cutting edge, that was in the 70s, apparently.
I just, for some reason, thought they were always like that. But no, you're right. Like, why would they have been?
Well, it makes total sense, given the forces at play and everything. I mean, psychology an accessible thing. Psychotherapy as an accessible thing is a very recent thing.
Right. And I didn't get the distinction at first in the early couple of episodes where I was like...
Oh, by the way, we're going to spoil...
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert.
But it's not really a spoilable show. You know, there's no twist.
Not really.
And it's based on true stories. So, so if you haven't seen it, I'm guessing if you watch after you listen to this episode, I'm guessing it's not going to...
Like, I don't feel like if you had told me... Everything that happens, with the exception maybe of the last scene or something, but only really, I mean, mostly there's nothing that spoilable.
Right.
But we're still going to spoil it.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is, in the first couple episodes, I actually was having a hard time distinguishing the difference between what the cops were saying their approach was and what these college people were saying their approach was. Because I kept thinking... Especially that first scene was sort of what I've come to expect of FBI or hostage negotiation stuff. Like, okay, that seemed on par. And then they're like, hey, we want you to teach a course. I'm like, okay, I think I know where this is going. And then all of a sudden, he talks to that one dude. And I'm like, at the very beginning, and the dude's talking about the change of the environment, the society is changing and all these things. And I'm like, okay. And all of a sudden, he's like, I'm going back to college. And then for a little bit, I was lost. I'm like, wait. Why hasn't he read that book? What do you mean he doesn't know about that theory? How is he in this FBI like thing and he doesn't know about that?
Right. It was good. It was good storytelling in that Fincher lets the story unfold.
Yeah.
It's very unclear what's happening.
Yeah.
And actually, I want to just talk a little bit about Fincher. After watching 10 hours straight of Fincher and his style, because the other directors followed his style.
Oh, right, yeah.
I figured out what distinguishes Fincher from other filmmakers. I'm guessing there are other filmmakers that do this too, but I think the combination that he has is that he creates an almost dreamlike vibe.
Yep.
Not only in a number of different ways, and it's hard to pinpoint, but I was really watching it this time. One of the ways he does it is with camera work.
Right.
If you notice, normally when, say you have a scene where the FBI agents are walking across a parking lot, they get into a car, and then the car drives off, and it's all one camera shot. Well, other directors would just do three camera shots.
Right.
They do them walking. they'd have another camera shot getting in the car, and then they'd have another shot them pulling away.
Right.
But with Fincher, he'll do all one shot. And what he does is, as they're walking, there's a perfect either crane shot or handheld where it's what do they call the it's the body cam where it's steady
yeah,
cam.
Steady cam.
So the camera seems almost like it's floating. There's no right. There's no jiggly, you know. And he always makes sure that the figures are very contrasted, almost like in Akira Kurosawa manner. Very you know, it's like when you take a snapshot,
right?
You always got to make sure that the figures are in the frame in this almost perfect compositional style.
Yeah.
So the people are walking, and instead of just letting them walk and shooting them, he's like, okay, I need you. And my guess is he choreographs these things like meticulously.
Yeah, it's kind of like a dance,
right?
Because like they hit on beats,
right?
And especially when there's audio, like there's music and stuff, like it also plays a role. It's really
right. Right.
Very,
because
very
like
purposeful.
If I'm sure they rehearsed it like 100 times, because in order to have both actors stay in the exact same compositional frame as they're walking,
yeah,
it's hard. And then when the car comes into the view, then now the car becomes a part of that composition.
And the door opens just at the right place, yeah. And the leg comes out. And absolutely.
Yeah, and everything is central. There's always a center focus. And so then the camera will pull out as they get into the car. And then as the car backs up, the camera perfectly keeps the car in the middle of the frame. So it's almost like, you know when they do that shot where they put a camera on the body of a person and have it like on an arm, and it's like, mm-hmm. And the person's running, and see, and their face is perfectly still.
You see their face, and then everything's kind of blurry behind
them. But everything behind them is all jostly. Yeah. Well, that's kind of a bigger version of what he does, but with every subject, it's always like he keeps it right in the middle. And again, he has to choreograph, okay, make sure you drive at 5 miles an hour back, because the crane is going to, because it's hard to move that kind of frame.
And he trains your eye focus really well.
Yeah.
And so then he can pull off moves like when he, remember in Seven when the quote unquote dead guy comes to life,
mm-hmm.
where you're like, there's that guy that had been tortured by being strapped to the bed.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like intently staring and he's like, you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And so like he's able to like draw you into like a point of focus, and like, yeah, it's really masterful.
Like when he has the tuna can with the cat in Mindhunter.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it's such a simple little scene, but somehow it has a danger to it.
That's
even though
she's
just putting tuna out for a cat.
Yeah, that scene felt very dangerous. Good way to put it. Very dangerous. And there was nothing really to it.
Right. And they didn't even wrap it up. Like, no. it's a cliffhanger for next season.
It seems like the cat's dead.
Yeah. Right. So it's very interesting show in that it the main through line, basically, is Holden trying to learn about why these people commit these crimes.
Right.
And how to get law enforcement to use and understand the benefits of trying to think about, these kinds of things. And we should say that this guy, the real guy who wrote this book, was, I think, part of the Unabomber, catching the Unabomber.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, or at least his division was.
Hmm.
I don't remember the details on that. No, I'm pretty sure it was him. Like, early on when they were looking, I don't have the notes in front of me, but I'm 90% sure this is true. So the guy who wrote the book, the Holden Holden Caulfield character, the Holden Ford character, later on when the Unabomber was blowing people up and killing people in the 90s, the FBI figured that he was just a low-life, uneducated idiot who worked for the airlines and stuff. And this guy comes along and he like starts piecing together his own clues, and said, no, I'm pretty sure this guy's really intelligent. He doesn't work for the airlines. and he's from this part of the country, and wow. blah, 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 like all these different
things. So the guy's the real deal.
and he was right. Yeah. You know? And anyway.
So, by the way, like, funny you mentioned Holden Caulfield, because as soon as the show started, I was like, I had no idea if it was based on a real story at all, but I thought.
Yeah, I didn't know until about like halfway through. Yeah. I was like, wait, is this a true story?
But I thought, oh, Holden, that's got to be a very deliberate choice for the name of this character.
Yeah.
But, and it was, because it wasn't the real name of the person. So they right. did pick it.
Right. So, the cops, as they are traveling around the country, are, and I guess some of the FBI agents are just like, why do you want to understand the psychology of these people?
Right. In fact, they were quite aggressive because there was that whole part where they were like, I was there. I was trying to capture, the Manson.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he was trying to, they felt he was like, minimizing him or condescending or whatever.
Well, and talking about how child abuse.
Oh yeah, like justifying. He was trying to justify it. It's like that guy's just the devil, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. And we still have that today.
Yeah,
but not necessarily in law enforcement. You know, right. In the public, there's definitely that sort of thing. But in law enforcement, I think the notion of trying to understand what. In order to catch them, you have to sort of get into their head. You know what I mean? Anyway, one episode ends with them getting a grant. You know, because at the end of every episode, there's sort of a like a something
twist.
Big
like
happens.
A twist.
something big happens just before the end, either a scary thing or a triumphant thing or a, you know, something to get you to watch the next episode. Well, one of the episodes ends triumphantly. With the three of them getting a grant, which I just have to point out is like an awesome thing to see for me as a scientist. You know what I mean? Like, like getting a grant. Yes. You know?
Yes. Great success.
Yeah. But you really, I think, understand through shows like this, how federal funds, essentially your tax dollar and like how politicians and how they can change history.
Yeah.
How there are people who make choices about that kind of thing. And if in the real life they had decided not to award that grant to those people, we would be 30 years back maybe.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And so as a tax paying public, we all need to pay attention to that and reward those politicians and those administrators who fund things that we think are worthy and defund things. You know, it's a very important part of the government, even like city governments, that I think is not looked at enough.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of interesting scenes. I mean, every scene is interesting, even though some of the scenes, if I just described them to you, you would be like, well, that doesn't sound very interesting.
Like the shoes or the scene where they have all the paraphernalia from the murder, and they have it like lined up, and it's just sitting there. And there's never like the super dramatic, do you recognize this? You know,
yeah.
It's just like subtle and in the background, but you see the person's reaction, and the person's reaction is subtle. The killer's reaction is subtle.
Right. There's no sensational shootouts or anything. There's no sensational strangulations or car chases or anything. Yeah.
There's very few. I guess the initial scene was a little sensational, and there's a couple other moments, but certainly minor by the, I mean, over the 10 episodes.
Yeah, I thought the gun, I mean, again, spoiler, it's in the first scene, but the guy shoots his head off.
Yeah.
Get clean off.
Yeah.
And I'm, even if that's possible, which I'm guessing it might be, it didn't look quite right to my eyes.
Well, and actually watching the rest of the show, I sort of felt like they might have filmed that early on.
Like a pilot, try to get the funding.
Because that's not at all the rest of the show.
Right. I loved the Debbie character. She's the girlfriend. I liked how Debbie she's a deep character in some ways.
Right, yes.
And
she's the one that gets him interested in a lot of the college stuff.
Right. And I like how one of the story arcs over a few episodes is she cheats on him.
Yes.
Or she was starting to cheat or something, getting, you know, she was getting real intimate with this one guy. And then they break up, and then he is walking by the laundromat. He sees her.
Right.
He goes in. The camera pulls out. We don't hear their conversation. And then later, there's another scene. They're back together.
Yeah, they don't spell it out.
Yeah, they don't. It's just like this, you know, these things happen.
Yeah.
And we're not going to have a big yelling scene or a crying scene or a, you know, a drama. It's just like, you know, they love each other. And then he's getting a little paranoid. She cheats because she's young and in college and blah, blah, blah. And I also like that she's not this sort of traditional bombshell good looks. You know what I
right.
mean?
Right. Yeah.
She seems like a normal human being. Do you know what I mean?
I will say, so the first episode, maybe the first two episodes, yeah, they did throw me a little bit because I didn't get the sense of the show till like the third episode because the dialogue in the first couple episodes was very deliberate, almost like Quentin Tarantino scenes. And it felt artificial. And at first I was okay with it because I thought I didn't know where the show was going. So like when he was talking to the guy that was telling him, you know, times are changed. The guy who was lecturing, and remember how he ends his lecture early because everyone leaves, and then he's walking down the hallway and he sees this other dude lecturing and then they go to lunch. Mm-hmm. That conversation was one of these like super quippy conversations. And I was like, okay, but I thought that's where it was going. Like, I don't know. I thought since maybe it's paranormal, I don't know, right?
Yeah.
And then when he met her at the club, it was the same kind of like super clever back and forths. And like, she could do no wrong with her quips. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. But seeing the rest of the show, I think that was sort of out of place because the rest of the show is not quite like that.
Yeah.
And it definitely tones it down. Like, I didn't get that feeling. You know, the rest of the episode.
Yeah, I want to get into that when we get into the what was bad about this show section. But before we get to that, I like that they're not making Holden autistic, which is a very trendy thing these days.
Oh, okay.
Right? It's like...
Oh, you mean like Dr. House or Sherlock Holmes? Or...
Yeah, I mean, if you just look empirically, I mean, there are times when he doesn't seem to care about what other people's reactions are or oblivious, but
way minor.
but it's pretty minor, and yeah. He has a girlfriend, and yeah. There's no scenes where it's like he doesn't get it. Just that he seems like he's innocent and naive from a small town,
and the cases where he quote unquote doesn't get it is because he's trying to be too elaborate in his explanations or too flowery or too poetic.
Yeah,
and then the dude's like, dude, these guys tone it down. These guys don't.
Right. It's just, I thought, oh boy, are they going to make him autistic when he's not? And I'm mostly sure they're not making him autistic, which I'm happy about. Not that I don't want autistic characters. I just hate this new trend of...
Only smart people can be autistic.
Right. If you're smart, you're autistic.
Yeah.
You know, or if you're really good at figuring things out, you're autistic. You know, it's like, what?
Yeah.
I like that whole story about the principal who tickles the feet.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really interesting storyline.
That was ambiguous. Very good.
Because they never really resolved it.
I was actually following it along going like... Oh, he's going to be proven right. He's going to be proven right.
He's going to kill one of those kids.
And nothing.
Right.
In fact, you have that emotional scene with the wife, like, confronting him. And then that's, as far as we know, that's it.
Right. Right. I liked that the general gestalt is that police work is hard and long. And sometimes you don't find the guy until he's killed for years.
And I also really liked that series with the district attorney, where they were like, you got to do it this way. It's the one brother, not the other, blah, blah, blah. And then the DA didn't do that, but he got some convictions. And then they're confronting him. And I think in a normal, quote unquote, movie or Hollywood thing, the district attorney would have been like a bad guy. Well, that's just the way the cookie crumbles. Instead, he's like, dude, I did the best I could. Thanks for the input.
Yeah.
No hard feelings.
Right.
And they're the ones who are like a little childish about it. Like,
right. They were.
You should have.
Yeah. They were being the dicks.
Yeah.
And he's just like,
Look at the outcome. Like, we actually got convictions.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's go to some of the bad stuff. The scenes with their unit chief are all ridiculous.
Wait, the unit chief is the guy who's always against them.
Yeah.
Like, what is it? Riggs? Is Riggs? Right. Riggs!
I mean... I can't imagine that Fincher doesn't know about the cliche where the boss of two cops is constantly getting in their way.
And almost in his defense, what I will say is it didn't start that way. Remember, he was the one who was like, you should lecture. And he's like, but I failed. No, you actually, it was great. You like, sure, the guy killed himself, but imagine everyone else could have been dead. So we liked that outcome. I think you should lecture. And then he's like, okay, yeah, I guess you can go to college. And then he slowly starts going like, I don't know about this stuff.
But yeah, the scenes are just so, if that's accurate, then fine.
Yeah.
But I just can't imagine how if you have a star group of three people who are doing some cutting edge stuff, solving actual crimes and trying to move your department forward, I just don't understand why he's so grumpy all the time. I mean, I guess what they need, now that I think about it, are scenes where he's being bitched out by some other group of people.
Yeah, the consequences for some of the things that he did. Because I guess maybe we're used to the, your little car chase cost us $3 billion and it killed 20. Instead, this was like, you talked to some inmate without permission.
Right.
So we were like, yeah.
So, you know, I think what we need is like his boss.
Yeah, like we're going to shut the whole thing.
Yelling at him and saying like, do you have any control over your agents? Like, yes. I'm gonna get rid of you. Yes. If you can't get control of your agents, I'm gonna get rid of you.
And maybe actually, in however way they could have done it, I think for the viewers, our maybe feeble minds, we could have used a little bit of like, why does this matter so much?
Right. Yeah. I mean, those ones I sort of get because it's like if you're an agent, you're going rogue.
Yeah.
But like, he would get upset about just everything, like any. Everything that happens.
I guess the funny thing is his level of upsetness was equivalent when he was like, I had an extra donut for lunch versus we lied and destroyed the evidence.
Right. Right.
And then he's actually like, well, now we got to cover it up.
Right. I mean, by the third time there was a grumpy police boss scene, I was like, is this a joke? You know? I also am getting very tired of the David Fincher green tint in every single scene.
Oh yeah, sure.
He has. I don't know if
he's colorblind.
Is he?
I don't know.
He always has a green tint.
Yeah,
and that's a part of his style, and it gives it that sort of dead or I don't know, dreamy, bleak. Yeah, bleak and dreamy.
Yeah,
and fine, but. If I am going, Jesus, that's a lot of green tint.
Turn it down.
Yeah, you know, like if I notice it like consciously, you've not done your job. It's supposed to be very subtle tint change. You know what I mean?
And like I was saying about the dialogue, I felt the show improved as the episodes went on in a few categories. One of them is that the dialogue started to get more normalized, whereas in that first one or two episodes, I thought they were going for something completely different because every word was so perfect.
Yeah.
Every answer was so perfect.
Well, in my opinion, the dialogue is one of the weakest things about the entire all 10 episodes. Mm-hmm. The dialogue tells a story, which is fine, but every single sentence, no matter what the emotion, is said in the same way. You know, maybe it's part of his whole dreamlike sort of vibe that he's going for, where it's like everything, I don't know, everyone talks the same. And there's a problem with directors doing that, where they basically, they take away the actor's ability to act.
I see.
And they force them all to, it's sort of like how every Woody Allen movie,
sure,
everyone talks like Woody Allen.
Sure.
Even though, you know, like if... Edward Norton is in a Woody Allen movie, he talks like Woody Allen. When Larry David is in a Woody Allen movie, he talks like Woody Allen.
Have you seen Extras, the Ricky Gervais
yeah.
show. So, you know how he has all the guests in each one of the episodes?
Yeah.
But almost every one of them were a version of like David Brent from The Office. Like
right.
it was Ricky Gervais in another actor's body.
Right.
Which actually worked fine because it's only six episodes and it's a comedy. And
right. Whatever. No, that show is hilarious. But when I was watching it, I was getting a little tired. I was almost a little wary of the way that people talked,
yeah.
you know, and just,
yeah.
I wish Fincher would have just said, I wish he would have just let the actors kind of be themselves a little bit
yeah.
more, you know?
Like part of me at first was like, is it just that like in the 70s, people just talked way more better? And I'm just way dumber.
Also, another thing I didn't like was that some of their analyses seemed way overconfident.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so now we're getting... Like, the thing that I thought was hilarious, and I was thinking of you the whole time, was as soon as we met the psychologist, the therapist, was she a psychiatrist?
The professor?
Gal, the professor, yeah.
Yeah.
What was she? Was she...
She's a professor. She's not a clinician.
Okay, but what was she a professor of?
Psychology or sociology okay, or right. anthropology.
So, as soon as we met her... They use the other cliche, which is, you know, oh, she's a professor. She's a psychology
professor. Okay. Yeah.
She's got some magical properties.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden she could dissect, you know, like they had a couple scenes where she's like, no, what happened was blah, 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 blah,
right.
blah, blah, blah. And it was like yeah. this perfect prognostication.
Yeah. That's ridiculous. Like one, no, that doesn't happen. And two, especially not back then,
right?
When the science was just beginning. Right. I mean, if we don't understand, how many people out there believe the police can predict who is going to kill someone?
And you know what I mean? Absolutely. And actually, it sort of would play better if it is someone, some character that's ancillary, but all of a sudden it turns out they have this kind of special gut feeling or really good way to read people. But they made it, oh, it's because she teaches psychology, she has this deep insight into everyone's mind.
Well, and also
and can predict everything.
They give that to Holden Ford too, in that like this super genius.
But see, I almost forgive it more because it's like randomly some FBI agent happened to have a really good knack at this.
Yeah, but what I wish they would do is a more realistic depiction, because mm-hmm. you know, it's the Sherlock Holmes problem where there's this interesting story apparently,
yeah,
in House and that kind of, it's just interesting apparently to audience, or they think it's going to be interesting, where someone can just look at a scene and figure it out, you know, instead of real life, which is gathering data,
yeah.
which they kind of show them doing, and then making hypotheses, maybe trying to test those hypotheses,
yeah.
and making guess, you know, general guesses, with some of them panning out and some of them not.
Yeah.
And then always trying to refine your... Right from the start, Holden and Dr. Wendy Carr, the way that the story is going, or at least the way that it feels as I'm watching it, these two people always know the right answer.
Right, yeah.
And the other guy never knows the right answer. He's always this bumbling...
Well, you know, but he can add a little bit of grit, street grit.
Right, now, and I'm getting a little tired of that, too. Like, he's always rolling his eyes.
Hold it.
I'm like, at what point are you going to realize that he's always right?
Like, he still stabbed him in the back with the interviews, remember?
Yeah.
So, I was going to say, the reason Seven worked so awesome for me so well is because... of what you were just saying. First of all, Brad Pitt was not the cleverest tool in the bunch in that movie, but on purpose, you know, that's his character. But he's, you know, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try to solve this. And then his partner is super smart. What's his name? The Voice, you know. Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
He's super smart, but he doesn't have these little diatribes of like, well, it's obvious from the evidence that blah, blah. No, instead he's like, well, I think we got to go read in the library. And then they go read for a while. It's like, well, I think we're looking for this. And they're sort of right. And then they go and by accident, they run into the killer. But then that almost kills one of them. And they're never fully right.
Right.
And I like that. You know, it's like, but you see their progress. You see their thing. In this one, there are those moments where it's like the scene from House or Sherlock Holmes where they're like, oh, what did you just say? Potato? That's what it was. It was, you know, right. The potato must have fallen in the pot, and the pot splashed, and then the person knew that.
Right. And so, and I'm just remembering some of the dialogue scenes. Well, let's take a break, and when we get back, let's continue. All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Go to patreon.com. When you become a patron, you get access to our premium feed, in which we have hundreds of patron-only episodes in which we do deep dives into various interesting topics. And when you're a patron and you listen to that feed, you don't have to listen to the vast majority of commercials. Also, I just published my book called Multi-Role Clinical Supervision. Multi-Role Clinical Supervision. You can buy it on Amazon. And it's a book about supervision, but people have been telling me that even though they're not in the field, they enjoy reading it.
So is this a real thing then?
What?
Like, we're now at this point? Like, I hadn't really read the news, but I'm so glad. Like, how do you get to have that supervision? Do you have to wear, is it the glasses you're wearing?
Great. I love it. I knew that was going somewhere, but, and I'm glad it paid off. Also, tell a friend about the podcast or post episodes on Facebook, you know, spread the word, you know, because a lot of times that's how people find out about
it. Yeah.
Also, join the Facebook fan group. I don't ever go there. You go there.
I've started to post more or like answer in a very professional manner. Mostly it's just sarcastic comments.
famous patron Lyndon moderates that.
Lyndon and I get into great back and forths, you know, all fun. Like, I'll make a little reference to something, and he'll add his own reference, and then we'll, you know.
It looks like he's grown quite a beard.
Oh, yeah.
Since the last time we saw him. Also, there's a live event.
That's right.
January 27, 2018, Antioch University, 3 o'clock. You can go to the Facebook page, not the fan group page, but the regular Facebook page, and we'll have updates on the event. But
nice.
We're going to, it's a live event for a couple hours, and then we're going to go to a nearby restaurant, bar, place that has video games and pinball and stuff.
It's like an Andy Kaufman show.
Right. And I was talking with Rebecca Bloom. She's going to be there too. And she's going to do a segment where people tell her, she's an art therapist, people tell, whisper something to her to draw, and then she's going to draw it, and then everyone has to guess it.
What? That sounds so fun.
Yeah. And apparently she has this, like, amazing ability to draw anything.
Oh.
Like, fast.
Wow.
So I can't wait to see that.
We should do it with me doing it, and that way no one can guess it.
Yeah, well, yeah, we could do, like, you and her both, and, you know.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And just see, like, what you come up with.
Right.
Also, join Talkspace. It's an online therapy group. A lot of people are letting us know that Talkspace is a good service. And you, yeah. I mean, it just connects you with a therapist. It's not their therapist. It's, you know, like I, for instance, could sign up as a Talkspace therapist if I wanted to.
Right.
And so they connect you with therapists, and a lot of people are saying it's really great. And use the promo code Kirk, because when you use the promo code Kirk, then they know that you're one of our listeners and they continue to sponsor us. Right. Also, if you're a $20 patron, you get a mug. I send out the mugs like every couple months, every few months. So it might take me a while to actually send you the mug. I thought we would send some swag to people. So let's look at some new patrons.
New.
And send some swag to some new patrons. Berto, pick a number between 1 and 10.
7.
Rose, patron Rose, you are in California. You're going to get some swag. Pick a letter between, I don't know, A and Z.
And then the letters that, yeah. Okay. All right, I'm going to go with a little H.
H, looking for an H here.
H for Umberto.
Gosh, how come I can't find an H? H, not a lot of names start with H. Pick another.
All right.
Oh, no, I got one here.
Okay.
Henning, but Henning doesn't have a address.
Oh, no.
Let's see. Give me another letter.
Okay, well, the nearest one, let's go to I.
Not a lot of, okay, Ian.
All Ian, right. There Ian. You go. See, poor Ian almost didn't get a treat.
Ian in Connecticut. And give me another letter.
All right, let's go further down to R.
R. Rebecca. Rebecca, nice. From England. From England.
Nice.
So patron Rose, Rebecca, and Ian, thanks to you for being patrons recently, and we will send you some swag in the mail. All right, so let's move on here. In some ways, as I'm looking at my notes here, in some ways, it's just another show that is obsessed with serial killers and one of the reasons why people commit these sorts of crimes.
Right.
Right? Because our fascination with serial killers and mass shooters and mass killers, it is, you know, weird, but innocuous in one way, but looked at another way, due to our media obsession over the years with these sorts of figures, when someone is suicidal or they just want to throw their life away, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and they're thinking about what they could do with their final minutes, a lot of people will go like, well, maybe I'll become another Ed Kemper, you know?
Hey, man, listen, name one, you know, famous scientist or humanitarian from the Wild West in the 1800s.
Right.
Oh, but there's Billy the Kid.
Jesse James.
Right.
Right, exactly.
These are sort of serial killers.
Right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like, who do we hold up as interesting figures? Yeah. And there's an interesting kind of back romanticization that happens, too, that I don't understand at all.
Mm-hmm.
That when you become, when there's enough time that goes by, like, there's a certain amount of people that worship Charlie Manson. You know,
that's true.
There's a certain amount of people like, ooh, you know, he's kind of an interesting
guy. Oh, and like Jack the Ripper became, over the years, sort of like this mysterious, romantic figure.
Yeah, he was a terrible, horrible, brutal, sadistic, just awful torturer of innocent people. And yeah, there's this weird thing that we do, you know? And so in some ways, when I watch shows like this, I'm just like, okay, you know, free speech, you can't like ban shows like this. But at the same time, our interest in it is what actually leads to this sort of thing happening in the first place some of the time.
Yeah.
And especially the spree killers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it just makes you, I don't know. And I don't know what to do about that.
Yeah. That's true. There is a morbid aspect to it.
And there was one moment about, I don't know, halfway through, two-thirds of the way through, one moment that was the dumbest thing I'd ever seen. Almost the dumbest thing. Not the dumbest, but definitely in the 10 episodes. I just was like, can you think of what it was?
Was it related to the brothers?
No.
Okay.
It was this one like real quick moment.
Okay.
Real quick like event that happened. And it's supposed to be for shock value.
Oh, really?
And I even paused it and went on the internet to see if it actually happened, because I'm like, that better have actually happened, because if it didn't, then that was really bad writing. You know what I mean?
Interesting. And it was supposed to be for shock value.
It's real fast.
Okay, I don't know. I mean,
it involved Speck. Do you remember Speck?
Which one's Speck?
The guy who had he was the guy. Well, anyway, he was one of the serial killers.
Yeah, but which one? Like
I don't know how to describe him, but he was. They only talked with him a couple times. He was very ornery with them.
The guy was really up. Like
he had the bird.
Aggressive.
He had the bird.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you remember the bird?
Yes, I do remember the bird.
So he throws the bird in the fan.
He throws it at the fan.
Yeah, that was the dumbest. That's along those lines of when you walk away from an exploding vehicle and you don't turn around.
Well, first of all, what kind of fan was that? Like
right.
A industrial strength disintegrator?
A bird killing fan.
A bird killing.
It was basically a lawnmower on its side.
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't see the show, there's this moment where this one serial killer, the FBI agents are interviewing him and they're pissing him off.
Yeah.
And he's been coddling and nursing this one tiny little bird back to health. And it's supposed to be this contrast, right? Because he's this total dick.
Right.
And this hardened serial killer. with all these badass tattoos. And
then he starts making fun of them. He's like, you believe what Ed Kemper told you?
Yeah.
You know, he told me he told me everything.
Right. And then without turning around, there's a fan like up and behind him. He just throws this bird into in the direction of the fan. It's probably 5 feet behind him. The bird instantly explodes. Like there's nothing left. You know what I mean?
Well, first of all, what you're not understanding, Kirk, is that for a lot of these serial killers have really amazing abilities to sense.
Yeah.
And they're so strong. Because the serial killerness gives their muscles this added strength.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and I was like, wait, did I just see? I thought maybe I didn't catch him turning around. Because if he turned around mm-hmm. and looked at the fan and then aimed the bird at the fan, I'd be like,
okay.
I'd be like, well, still stupid, but because there's the fan has a protective thing on it.
Of course. Well, even if it didn't, like. No fan is going to disintegrate. Like, the bird disintegrated.
Right, right, right. Like, you would have, hurt it, but it probably wouldn't have killed it. You know what I mean? So he just chucks it over his shoulder, like those YouTube videos where guys, throw a basketball over their shoulder and it goes swish, you know? It's like, and he doesn't turn around to see if the bird died. Like, as far as he knows, he just threw the bird at the wall, and it's flying around the room right now. He doesn't even know.
Right.
He just throws it. Boom. It's dead. He knows it somehow. And he's like, and he delivers some stupid line, you know? And I'm just like, so I was like, what? And again, I Googled it and they found out that never happened. You know, he never nursed a bird. So that was the writers inserted that ridiculousness in.
Right.
Anyway, like I said, 7 out of 10.
Yeah. No, I mean, overall, I like the mood. I like the stories. I did enjoy learning about the FBI and how they discovered how to leverage psychology, the serial killers. But there were things.
So let's talk about some of the killers. So every episode begins in Wichita, Kansas,
know,
or here in Kansas. And there's this ADT guy
mm-hmm.
who we never see him kill anyone.
Not yet.
But he looks like something's up with
menacing.
That guy.
And he was yelling at that one dude in that one scene. Yeah. And then towards the end, we see his horrific drawings where he binds, tortures.
Right. Do you know who this is? Like in real
binds,
life?
Binds, tortures, and kills.
Yeah, right. So it's a Kansas real guy, Dennis Rader, called the BTK killer.
Spoiler!
Or the blind torture. It's not a spoiler, really. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's
no,
not.
I mean, it is if you didn't look it up. But I looked it up.
Yeah.
Well, because I was sure it was a famous serial killer, because why would they be showing? So I just looked. All I did is Kansas serial killer, and the first thing that popped up was BTK. Right. I was like, all right, it's got to be BTK.
But I think it makes it, I mean, one, if you're a Kansas person, you probably know.
Yeah.
And two,
if it had been Seattle,
right,
and you had a dude riding around in a little,
right. I kept waiting for the Green River Killer to show up,
right.
But
I was thinking of Ted Bundy.
Oh, Ted Bundy, yeah. But so we have, he works for ADT. He killed from 74 to 91.
Jeez.
So what is that like 16, 15, 17 years? He was caught, and he wasn't caught until 2005. So for 30 years, he was free. He was a family man. He had kids. He had a job. He was just a total normal guy living a total normal life.
So he wasn't a typical dysfunctional.
Right. He had two kids, and his daughter actually wrote a book about growing up with him and then finding out about his secret life.
So maybe he was more like a sadist than a...
Well, I haven't looked into his psychology, but it's just an interesting presentation.
Yeah.
You know, not your typical, right?
Crazy.
That so the killers that we see interviewed, Ed Kemper being one, we've talked about that. There's actually a Sword and Scale. There's a podcast called Sword and Scale. I don't know if you know about it. Mm-hmm. But the podcast is about different crimes, and it's pretty interesting because they will have interviews, and so they'll have it's not just us talking about things. They'll actually have clips, a lot of clips. You know?
Interesting.
And this Sword and Scale episode about Ed Kemper is, there's a lot of interview footage talking to Ed Kemper about what he did. And he's an interesting guy because he, in the span of a couple of years, he killed like 8 to 10 people or something at least. And he would dismember them and then have sex with like, he would. So just to let you know, we're going into a section where we're talking about these killers, and I'm not going to go into full detail, but I feel like some of the details need to be mentioned. And so if you don't like talk about rape and killing and necrophilia and stuff,
who doesn't like that?
I would just skip it. But anyway, Ed Kemper would cut off the heads and then have sex with the throat, right?
Yep, that's what they say.
Right, and so. He was, when he was 15, he murdered both of his grandparents.
Right.
And he was sent to a mental hospital and released at the age of 21.
By the way, one of the things that I didn't like is that in several of these cases, they wrapped up the reason too neatly. Ah, it was the way the mom treated him.
Right.
And it's like you don't see that with Bundy or Ed or none of the major, well, like when they interview them, they'll say things and you may, well, maybe that played a role. Well, maybe that played a role. But there's never like this clean cut. It was the day my dad made me take the garbage out.
Right. It's a completely ridiculous notion when you just think about one fact, which is how many boys are abused?
Yeah.
And how many of them grow up to be killers like Ed Kemper?
Right.
We're talking like 0.00001% of the people who have the exact same background as Ed Kemper result in cutting off people's heads and having sex with the throat. You know,
it's, I mean, like how many of them killed someone out of anger from their abuse, let alone the extreme, extreme, extreme.
Right. Exactly. So,
yeah.
So that's another part of the show that bothers me in that. If you don't know that and you watch the show, then you're going to be like, oh, I get it. Like when you're treated badly as a kid or.
And it's like a 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
Because it's not just that they were treated badly. It's like she, you know, what was it? She liked people looking up to her. So I buried the heads looking up at her. That explains my crimes. You know, that's a metaphor for like one action led to that reaction.
Right.
It's clear.
Right.
It's clean cut.
Right. Exactly. I mean, the fact is FBI included, no one understands why Ed Kemper and other people like him do what they do.
And in the interviews I've watched of these sorts of folk, they themselves will not have good reasons. You know, like remember Ted Bundy's like, I honestly can't tell you. I had a good family life growing up. Dahmer, you know, like there are different things, but they don't have it solved. And then they try to come up with theories. Like Dahmer had this whole thing about how, yeah, I think it was the pornography. Oh, no, Ted Bundy. I think it was the pornography that really did it to me.
Yeah.
And then he was like actually militant about it. Like, I think they should ban pornography.
Right. Yeah. To this day, every now and then, we'll get an email about our episode on Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember making an episode?
Yeah. Oh, of course I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember what we said, but I loved making that episode.
That was one of the first episodes that I kind of went off script, really. I felt, anyway, it was also the sort of the beginning of my abilities to do research, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I remember I watched documentaries and I took notes and everything, but I probably should have done more because like every now and then, every third email that I get about that episode is like, you got the entire thing wrong because there's so much bad information out there and I repeated it. But that episode was in 08 or early 09. Yeah.
That's crazy.
And another part of that episode was that our camera guy wasn't there.
Yeah, right.
So we were still doing video podcasts and I filmed it by just putting a couple video cameras on a tripod and then we just sat in my office on my couch.
I do remember that, yeah.
And we just, me and Lita just talked about it. And it's the only episode in which we did that where we just sat in my office and at some point beyond that, I just went to audio because I'm like, why do we have to look at us while we talk, you know? And I have a very snazzy Argyle a sweater vest on.
Okay.
I remember that much.
Yeah, I mean, basically, imagine if every, like, does anyone watch porn?
Right.
What is, like, imagine if the billions of dollars industry, everyone that consumed porn turned into a serial killer.
Right. So just to wrap up, Ed Kemper, during his 1973 trial, he requested that he be killed by torture as punishment for his crimes. He actually is kind of an advocate for wanting to stop people like him in this weird way.
That's right. In the show, didn't they ask him, well, what do you think should be this? Like, death by torture.
Right. Yeah. He's still alive today, age 69, and he believes he should not be released to protect the public. So going on, Richard Speck was the other one with the bird. Mm-hmm. He was abused as a child, similar to Ed Kemper. He started committing small crimes. He got married, had a child. He abused his wife. And then one day he goes into this. He finds out that in Chicago, there's this townhouse that is home to a bunch of nurses, mm-hmm. a bunch of nursing students, I think. And this is 1966. And so he knocks on the door and then he forces his way in. And I think he has a gun, mm-hmm. and he rounds up all the girls and then proceeds to beat them, brutalize them and kill them. And he raped at least one of them.
Yikes.
But, and all the women were, you know, young, like 19 to 24. And I was reading this one thing and they hypothesized that. So one of the women got away and what they're saying was, there were so many women that he killed that night, he couldn't keep track of all of them. And the one that actually let him in to the house at first, she ran and hid underneath a bed and he never found her.
Wow.
And so after he left, she ran out and got help and able to finger him for the, and he went to prison and died in prison 25 years later. Jerome Brudos is the guy with the shoes. He killed four women in Oregon in the late 1960s. He was born in South Dakota. You can go online, actually, on YouTube. There's lots of documentaries about these people, interviews with them. There's this very creepy interview with Richard Speck that you can watch, in which he's like, I don't care. I don't have any remorse about it. And he's just, it's just interesting.
I haven't seen that, but I can imagine. I saw an interview with a serial killer. This is a while ago. No one famous, at least I'd never heard of him. And he was basically talking about that lack of feeling about the stuff, you know, and it was just so depressing.
Yeah. So Jerome Brudos, he was abused also by his mom. He found a high heel shoe. He found a pair of high heel shoes at the garbage dump when he was five, brought it home and put them on and started wearing them just as a kind of a joke as a kid or something. Mm-hmm. And his mom became extremely increasing her abuse of that because she didn't like him doing that. And I'm guessing that, and there's a lot of speculation about this guy because it's like, there's a lot of data to speculate on. And I'm going to do the same in terms of at an early age, he must have had a very complicated relationship with his mom. You know, he hated her, was afraid of her and loved her and wanted her approval and wanted her love. And here she is. And then he puts on her shoes essentially and starts walking around. So that's interesting. And then she proceeds to beat him, you know, and say, you can't do that. And then he starts to hide these shoes and he starts to associate women's clothing with what he wants. And I'm guessing it's because there's a compulsion, a weird thing where you want to identify with the abuser because you feel powerless.
Right.
When the abuser is abusing you, you feel powerless. And one of the ways you can cope with that, among various other ways, is to identify with the abuser because they have so much power. Mm. So you look to that. It's like, I feel powerless. Well, how do I get power? You know, how do I become powerful? Well, who do I know who has power? Well, this person who abuses me all the time. Mm-hmm. She wears high heel shoes. She wears women's underwear. She, you know, and so I'm going to start wearing that stuff. Now, who knows, you know, and maybe it was just, he just maybe there were some gender issues with him, you know, sure. Who knows. But anyway, he eventually...
So the point is, if a kid wears high heels, they will become a serial killer.
That's right. He spent his teen years in and out of psychotherapy and psychiatric hospitals. He actually went to the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest hospital in Oregon, the same hospital that was written about. He began to stalk local women as a teenager, knocking them down and choking them unconscious and taking their shoes.
What are the stats on this? Like, it feels like I hear these stories in several of those cases. Like, they were in facilities at the age of 15, but eventually they were out, and then they killed a whole bunch of people.
Right. So again, it's tempting to now that there are commonalities among these people. There are a lot of men. There's not a lot of women.
Right.
You know, the vast majority of them are men. So that's one thing. They are often white.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they have often been mistreated as children. They often have parents who have issues themselves of some kind, and they often have an escalation of behaviors. You know. But out of the people who fit that profile in America, the amount of people who go on to kill anyone, right, as we've been saying, is like 0.001%. You know, how many guys have problems as teenagers, end up in a psychiatric hospital for some reason, and are released and never kill anybody? You know, it's got to be, you know, 99.999% of that those people. So it is interesting to look at the commonalities, but it's tempting to say, well, like, therefore all we have to do is look for this profile and we'll be able to stop it. Yeah. And that's just not true.
Or even if it were true, you might end up imprisoning or doing whatever with 99% of people that would have been fine.
Having said that, there are certain hallmarks that you could make predictions around that are better than just chance, right? Like someone who tortures cats as kids,
right,
and then as a teenager rapes somebody,
yeah,
and then stabs someone in a sort of like, they're not for no real reason, you know. Yeah. They're just like, they're not desperate for money and they're not mugging someone. They're just like, they just are, you know, they just stab someone, or they stalked the three of their girlfriends and made verbal threats to hurt them or something. You know, like, there's a certain prediction. You're like, well, and I think the justice system tries to work with that. I think they start looking at those things and go like, there's a much greater chance that this guy is going to move forward and, you know, do kind of bad things. But anyway, so age 17, he abducted and beat a young woman, threatened to stab her if she did not follow his sexual demands, and he was arrested for this. Actually, what he did was he had a neighbor and, you know, liked her and got her somehow into his house. Like, invited her over something. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh, wait a second. And then he leaves the room and he comes back with a mask on, like a, you know, like a stocking cap pulled over his face. And he's like, you know, I think he has a knife or something. He's like, take your clothes off or I'm going to kill you. And so she takes her clothes off and then he takes pictures and then he runs out of the room and then he comes back without the mask on.
What?
And he says, I went into the garage and some guy knocked me out. And what happened?
My God.
What happened? Like, what, you know, what? And the girl's like, I know it was you, asshole. Like, and she runs out of the house and then she calls.
Oh, my God.
Like, not the brightest bulb.
No.
You know?
That's incredible.
So he gets caught for that. He gets sent to a psychiatric ward for 9 months. They assess him. They thought that his sexual fantasies revolved around his hatred and revenge against his mother. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which I always find interesting. Is like, a lot of these people get diagnosed with schizophrenia when they, I haven't seen, I mean, of course, I don't have the assessment in front of me, but I don't see any evidence of psychosis. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
It seems like schizophrenia, maybe back then, was just sort of thrown around for people that they just didn't understand. But
I have a question. Yeah. So the person that does this, that does sort of like these behaviors, I noticed that in a lot of cases, they have, there's a theme around sexuality, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them seem to be.
Yeah.
And we've talked about before how growing up, it's never safe or okay to talk about your sexual fantasies.
Right.
And how interesting it would be if from a very young age, you have a forum or a mechanism or a way, and you're encouraged and it feels safe to talk about your fantasies, even grotesque, even weird stuff, and somehow that can guide counselors into what to do about people, you know, and how to help those people grow up. And I don't know if it'll help these extreme cases, but it feels like, for one thing, they get into a point where now they're adults, and in many cases, they're sort of like not very socially capable, so they're not going to get a girlfriend. And so I feel like this almost mounts to their frustration.
Right. I think that it's... again, it's impossible to lock this down. It's impossible to lock down in you and me, let alone, and we have all of our thoughts available to we, can, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and it's, so therefore it's impossible to understand these people. But yeah, it's weird that there's often a sexual component. And it seems to me that it could be a number of things. One is that you could just say that a lot of people with social problems are sexually frustrated, and therefore when they commit crimes like this, they're like, well, I might as well get off too. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like I'm having trouble. I want to have sex with women and I'm having trouble with that.
Right.
And I really want to kill because I'm really upset at my mom, or I have all this rage inside. I mean, cause to me, like, that seemed to be like a pretty big through line for me, was
right.
The amount of rage, justifiable rage that these men had, and how society teaches men to take action. Right.
Right.
And how society teaches men that they can't talk about their feelings. So maybe that's why women don't do this sort of thing, is because they might be suffering similarly, but internalize it or kill themselves more often or something, or try to kill themselves more often or something. And so a lot of these guys had a lot of justifiable rage towards women, and then they proceed to displace and transfer all that rage onto innocent young women.
Yeah.
And then one hypothesis about the sexuality piece is like, well, I might as well have sex with them too. I might as well rape them as well.
Yeah.
Because the killing seems to be like a dominant part of it, right? To me, anyway.
Yeah. Because it's not just like, I'll see if I can get away with raping. Because you would think, like, if your sole goal was the rape part and you don't want to get caught,
right,
then like things like blindfolding or knocking them out temporarily or something. But then there's like the dismemberment and the eating and the stuff. It's like just the crazy extreme stuff.
Right. And they talk about this in Mindhunter, actually, I believe, in which they hypothesize that it has to do with like just further humiliation of the object.
Yes.
You know? And so...
That, but, Ed Kemper specifically says, like, I just wanted to, you know, debase her.
Right. Like he had sex with the corpse of his dead mom.
With the head.
Yeah.
And it's like,
So it's just like further. And it, actually, if you watch that document, have you seen Mommy Dead Dearest? Mommy Dead Dearest? Is that what it's called?
Huh. No.
You have to watch it. It's really good. I did a whole episode.
Oh, really? Is it a documentary?
Netflix came out recently.
Oh, okay.
And it's about this mom who has this daughter, and she has what they used to call Munchausen by proxy, where you manufacture illnesses for your child and then get your kid on a lot of meds, get them surgeries and all these things. And then eventually something horrible happens and sex is involved. I don't know. You have to watch it.
Oh my God. Okay. I'll watch that.
It's a really good documentary. For a number of reasons, but also one of the great things about the documentary is because she was so vocal and public about her daughter's problems of having like leukemia and all these like fake illnesses, she would actually get a lot of charities to give her money. And one of the things that charities like to do is parade their benefactors in front of the camera. Mm. If like we've been helping this family out. And so there's all this video footage of awards and like benefits. Oh, wow. And all these things where you see this young girl growing up as she ages. Anyway.
One thing that occurred to me while I was watching the show is we've talked a little bit before about how there's this new theory or more recent theory about the role that fear might play.
Right, in the development.
Lack of fear.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if this is related because I
Well, so just to chime in on that so people don't remember is, if you are born genetically with a brain that doesn't have as much fear or doesn't have a fear response as much as other people are born with, then you have a harder time empathizing because the part of the development of empathy is fear of a reprisal upon bothering someone else. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have any fear, then you might not develop empathy. So go on.
Well, I was going to say that because one of the things, like, I'm so afraid, or I sit there and I listen to, oh, and then he like had sex with the corpse, right? And in my mind, the first thing that's going through, which is maybe wrong, but the first thing that's going through my mind is, what about all the bacteria and the viruses and they could catch so many skin diseases and stuff like that, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm wondering if for no other reason, so fine, you don't care about humanity. You don't care about being nice to people. Don't you like care about your health? And what's that? Like, I wonder if that's related to the fear thing. Like, no, they're not really afraid of stuff like that.
Yeah. On that note, let's take a break. All right. Back from the break. Again, become a patron of the podcast. Go to patreon.com. Also, buy my book on Amazon called Multi-Role Clinical Supervision. So just to further speculate or, you know, to present the various speculations as to how these kind of things develop. One is genetics, is that you have a genetic disposition toward psychopathy and meaning that you don't have empathy for other people and you're born with a brain that's more susceptible to developing a personality in which you're very narcissistic and self-serving and or you're born with a brain also that takes pleasure in harming other people, mm-hmm. either sexually or physically, and or physically. So that's one point of view.
And then maybe because you were born with all those genetic components, your parents might have aspects of those, and as a result, or other family members, and as a result, you might be in an environment that further triggers
right.
whatever you were going to have.
Right. If one or both of your parents are also lacking in empathy and like to harm other people, then not only are you going to get that genetic component, but you're also going to get abused quite a bit and yeah. further solidify those kinds of thoughts and feelings. So that's one thought. And then the other hypothesis is the abuse or mistreatment hypothesis, which, you know, seems to hold some weight. The other is it some kind of sexual drive that has gone wrong? Mm-hmm. Because as we know, when you want to have sex, you know, with the target that you like having sex with.
Right.
If you're a heterosexual male and you like having sex with
a watermelon.
With
Wait, what? What? Oh, that, I thought you were okay, sorry.
That was the funniest. What every now and then you really have a good zinger. So and you want to have sex with attractive women that you find attractive. Mm-hmm. And you somehow, society just was such that it didn't allow you to do that.
Right.
Then you could imagine a guy trying to figure out a way to make that happen. Mm-hmm. Right. So he might, you know, say the society is reversed back, you know, like homosexuality is the norm or something. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, well, let's make it real. So homosexuality in the 50s.
Right.
And you live in Ohio and you're 25 mm-hmm. and you've never had sex with a man. You've never kissed right. a man. You're a dude and you're a gay dude and you've
but
never
you have those feelings.
Yeah. You've never had the caress of a gay man. You've never looked into a gay man's eyes. You've never you've never had sex.
Right.
And, you know, you're busting at the seams. And, you know, one night you get a little drunk and you're at a bar and you see a guy that you're attracted to and you go up to him and you might start kind of trying to flirt with him.
Right.
And then you go outside for a cigarette or something. You're like, hey, can I kiss you? You know, like, even though your sober mind would be like, not a good idea.
Right.
You could get hurt. You know, the drive is just so strong. You can't just say, well, I guess I can never have sex again. You know, right. I guess that's my lot in life. You know, there's a drive.
That's right.
Well, if for whatever reason you're born with or you somehow weirdly developed this like massive sexual, like very narrow sexual attraction to a particular kind of thing, like, mm-hmm. like struggling bodies, struggling women or dead women for that matter, then is that what it is? You know, and then throw in psychopathy and lack of empathy and an abuse history. Mm. And then is that what it is?
Right.
Because that's the way some people talk about it, is that mm-hmm. it's like a sexual compulsion that builds over time, an itch that they have to itch.
Yeah.
And there's so many reasons not to do it because they're going to go to prison or blah, blah, blah. But they have to itch that itch and it just builds and builds. And so, you know, that's what creates the serial nature of it, right?
That's certainly how, yeah, like Ted Bundy talked about it and others. Yeah.
Right. So
it makes it sound not that it is
okay.
Okay. It's just that they're like, oh, I can't not do this.
Right. Another possibility is it self-hatred, which is something that I think is a way of looking at this, and in that when you're abused, you end up hating yourself. Mm-hmm. And then one of the paths of self-hatred is self-sabotage. You, as an adult, just start, you basically create a terrible life for yourself in which no one likes you. And then you proceed to harm other people and put yourself into the line of fire of the justice system mm. because you hate yourself so much. You know what I mean? When you hate yourself, there's a lot of ways, a lot of dysfunctional ways that this comes out, and maybe it's through this sort of thing. I don't know.
That is interesting.
All right, so let's talk about some of the music that was in the because the music plays a pretty key.
Yeah.
There's a lot of key songs where you're like, oh, you know, 1975. Right. You know, what do you think of the music?
Yeah, I liked. I usually really enjoy the sound design and. It's not always songs. Oftentimes, it's orchestral.
In Fincher.
Yeah, in Fincher movies. So in this case, definitely both the music, the sound design, and the songs were well paired.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the songs?
Not right now, but
I'm sure it was. Well, so for me, some of the songs, it was sort of like a Stranger Things for me. And, you know, it's like, oh, I remember right. that feel and that song. But some of the songs felt a little on the nose.
Well, and keep in mind that if you might have been hearing some songs where you actually consciously remember from that era.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, it might have been songs I heard later in life.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So like Peter Frampton and
oh, yeah.
I'm not in Love by 10cc.
Which that
not
one.
Not in Love.
They used it in Guardians recently.
Da, da, da. Yeah. I actually learned how to sing that song.
Oh, yeah.
And play it. It's a great song.
It is. I really like it.
Toto, Hold the Line. Dun, dun,
when did
dun,
they
dun.
Play that one?
Love Is It Always On Time.
Is that when they're meeting for the first time?
And then Don McLean, Crying.
Oh, yeah.
Cry. And then Fly Like an Eagle.
Right.
To the Steve Miller Band, Seattle. Steve Miller. A Fifth of Beethoven by Walter Murphy. Do you remember this? You probably don't remember this because you were too young or in Columbia or something. There was this thing that happened in the 70s where they started to rock up.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Beethoven.
I only remember hearing some of those on the radio, but I didn't think of it as a phenomenon.
It was like a trend over a couple years.
I see.
You know,
right.
You know, like it was,
yeah,
And it's like you got this disco beat underneath it and everything. Right. And it's actually pretty cool.
In fact, they have that one in Boogie Nights, remember?
Yeah.
At the beginning.
Psycho Killer by Talking Heads, pretty...
Psycho Killer.
That was one of the on the nose.
Let's just say.
Yeah. Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty.
Oh, yeah, right.
The saxophone. Yeah. That's actually a great song. People make fun of it, but I love it.
No, I like that. I like that song.
Let's see. Albatross by Fleetwood Mac. It's before the Fleetwood Mac we know and love, there was a different Fleetwood Mac, and it was... They were kind of like a progressive rock, and it's this epic instrumental that they...
Wow.
It's great. Anyway. I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rats, which I didn't realize was such a... I consider that an 80s song, but it's, I guess...
Wait,
it's,
which... How does that one go?
I don't like Mondays. It's just like... Let's see. I can't remember the exact melody, but... In the Light by Led Zeppelin.
Right.
And... Hot Child in the City by Nick Gilder. So we have some cliffhangers at the end. The Cat with the Tuna. We got the ADT guy. We got the fraud investigation was a cliffhanger too, right?
Absolutely. Right now, I mean, as far as we know, they're in deep water horizon.
Yeah. Netflix hasn't officially renewed it for a second season.
Really?
Yeah. And
I mean, I felt like it was highly rated. Lots of people were talking about it.
Right. Maybe it has by now, but...
Okay.
I mean, part of it might be... Fincher might be, like, holding out for a better deal or something. I don't know. But yeah, so...
I also wonder... maybe not with Fincher, or who knows. Like, right now, how many audits are being done of stars and directors and writers?
Sexual harassment.
They don't want to go into new projects.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? They're like, all right, I'm not signing a single new deal. I want investigations up and down the board.
Well,
who's coming out with what dirt?
You know who would actually probably be mostly interested in it is the insurance companies. Because a lot of these projects have insurance.
That's right.
You know, where it's like, they have clauses where it's like, if an actor becomes incapacitated or... Maybe even there's a clause in there, like, if an actor becomes so toxic halfway through production with their PR, then insurance will kick in. And so I wonder if insurance companies are actually, you know, raising their rates. If you have any men over the age of...
Oh, no.
I mean, did you see the Al Franken one?
Yeah.
God it's, damn.
It's really tough because it's going to come... It's just more and more going to come out.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was wondering. I'm like, man, signing new deals must be getting tough.
Yeah. So the weird thing about this show is that David Fincher said that if he does have a next season, he's going to go into the Atlanta child murders of 1979 to 1981, in which a serial killer took the lives of 28 African-Americans, mostly children.
Geeks.
In the Atlanta area. So that he's saying... He wants to eventually tell that story. So it's like if they do have the next season, maybe they'll jump forward a few years into that zone. But to me, I'm like, well, eventually they've got to get to the ADT
guy. You better pay off on that one because the whole season we're like, that's going to be the final boss this season. Nope.
Yeah. But the ADT guy was caught in 2005. So,
oh, right.
So, what are they going
to
do there?
Right. So, they're going to have to start maybe following it, but fast forwarding. That could be an interesting thing, right? If they start each season fast forwards in time.
Like 5 years or something?
Something like
well,
that.
Well, even if they did that, the ADT guy won't get caught until like season 7. And he was like at the beginning of every single episode in season 1, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like a dumb choice on their
part. Which actually I would respect that choice. Maybe that's not the usual end of credits scene, so to speak. Maybe that is a looming threat.
I mean, it would be interesting if they had like 5 seasons or even three or 4 seasons. And like at the beginning of every episode, they have a kind of enigmatic ADT guy scene.
And it's sort of driving home that's kind of how it was like.
Yeah, he was just...
No one caught him.
For 30 years.
He just kept going.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know.
Man, that would be mad respect if they did that.
The show might also have interviews with Charlie Manson, and David Berkowitz and Ted Bundy next season. They're talking about, because they kind of tease that a little bit, you know, right? You know, Holden was like, I think I'm going to get a talk with Ted Bundy. You know,
oh, did he say that?
I thought he did. I thought he said Charlie Manson.
When was Ted Bundy
caught? That's a good question.
Was it still 70s?
If only I had researched this.
If only we had done an episode about this.
Yeah. So you're looking forward, it sounds like, it to another season.
Well, topic alone is enough, let alone that it'll probably improve, you know?
Yeah.
And I already liked it. So if it stays or gets better, it's win-win.
Yeah. I am extremely skeptical and have very low expectations for second seasons of anything.
Of anything, yeah.
You know, Heroes, Downton Abbey, what other shows just completely disappointed me in the second season?
Lots of them.
Lost. With Mindhunter, I'm like,
well, I see. I thought that
maybe if it's good, then great. But if it takes a, you know, a drop off, you know,
I felt like Lost didn't drop till 3, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, answer me this: first season of Lost is amazing, right?
Yes.
Okay. So
one of the best things.
Second ever. Season was kind
it
of
it was a drop from the most amazing thing ever. Yeah. Yes.
It was riding that on the true. Coattails,
but
it hadn't gone completely down the tubes. Like the way it did season 3 and on.
And because I will say the sharpest drop off in shows like that probably was Heroes.
Oh, God.
You know?
Yes.
Heroes, almost everyone thought the first season was great.
Yeah.
But I did see a little glimmer of crap at that very last fight because they sort of like, it was anticlimactic, but I was like, okay. And then the second season, it was like, time travel? Holy shit, right? And then it was like, oh, that's it?
Yeah.
And then from there, it was garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. I similar to Lost with Heroes, the premise was good and they had a good idea to get the thing going. And
but they hadn't written out
the full arc. Yeah.
Yeah, the arc.
And they with both of those shows, the first season was based on withholding satisfaction, right?
Yes.
Because like in Heroes, you had people with powers that they were discovering, and they weren't very powerful yet.
Not yet.
And Skyler was one of the most terrifying villains of all time.
Yeah, they did that really well.
He and things hadn't blown out of proportion yet. You know, second season, the powers were so big by that point.
Well, remember they had to nerf everyone artificially. They had to have that whole eclipse thing, and now everyone's back to baby form.
Right. And then they went to season 3, in which they were like, okay, we got to like really do this good. And they completely went off the rails.
Do you remember Skyler kept going from good to bad to good?
Yeah.
To bad. I think that the Lost didn't blow its load the first season.
Right. So that's another thing. It lost first season. A lot of mysteries. But like not so many mysteries.
Right. Right.
And
you were left at the end of the season going, I definitely want more.
Yeah.
The problem with Heroes is we felt we want more because we enjoyed it, but they did blow their load.
Right. Yeah.
They were like, they basically got to Superman level and so what should have happened is like that would have been a good movie. Like that would have been the movie.
Yeah.
But instead they're like, well, now what do we do?
Right. What they should have done with second season would be like maybe kill some of the characters.
Yeah.
Or keep their powers under a certain level. Or diverge into some other storyline or something, you know.
Yeah. And in some ways, I mean it was a brave move to say, you know, Peter's going to lose all his powers, right? It's like, okay, I get applause initially for that. But the rest of the writing didn't keep up with those brave decisions, and so you end up with silliness.
Yeah.
But how did we get to Heroes? Yeah.
Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. This episode is dedicated to all those people who emailed us and said, why haven't you talked about Mindhunter yet? So there you go.
You know, Siler would have been a great...
Oh, Siler. Sorry, not Skyler.
Would have been a great interviewee in Mindhunter.
Ooh. But he just would have cut
killed everyone.
Cut their heads off.
Yeah.
All right, that does it for that episode. Please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.